This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week on the show, the Federal Minister of Seniors dials in to talk about promises such as the National PharmaCare Program and increases in old age security. We'll chat with a friend of a very popular Cape Breton storyteller, educator, and broadcaster who recently passed away, and a conversation with Keith Mullins and three Cape Breton artists about the release of their new music to Bandcamp. These stories are coming up on the Coast. The Federal Minister of Seniors, Deb Schult, calls in this week to chat with Dialogue's Dave DeVoe, and they cover a number of topics, including a promise for a national PharmaCare program, increases in old age security, and they started with a recent federal budget and what it means for seniors.
Okay, so Deb, you just passed a budget with a number of highlights in it for seniors. One of them is the increase to the OAS. It's for people 75 and older. I know some people are taking a bit of an issue with the 75 cutoff. Some critics have suggested that maybe two classes of seniors are being created under and over 75. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, first I just want to say, you know, it really was a great budget for seniors because we are delivering on our campaign commitment to increase the OAS by 10% for Canadians 75 years and older. And don't forget the $3 billion that we're putting on the table to support the provinces and territories. This is additional funding in what we've already provided over the last year to support the long-term care sector. And in this $3 billion is to ensure standards for long-term care are applied and permanent changes are made, because we saw the tragedies in long-term care, and we need all three levels of government to be stepping up and making sure that the future's better for our seniors in long-term care. We're also investing $90 million for a new Age Well at Home initiative that funds services by community groups that help seniors live longer at home. And I heard that when I was in Nova Scotia a year ago. I heard that this is an important initiative that we need to be helping seniors stay in their home. They'd rather stay in their homes than be in long-term care if they can. And I had many groups, including the province, asking, can the federal government be there to help seniors stay in their home longer? And so we stepped up to do that with this new program. But you raise the concern that, you know, why do we do 75 and older? We know as seniors age, they are facing more pressures, becoming more disabled, needing more supports, and they have rising healthcare costs. They have more needs that make financial pressures on them. They also become widowed, more become widowed, and that adds to their financial and emotional stress. And they are living longer. I mean, you look back at the over the years, in the last 50 years, the increase of life expectancy has gone up about 10 years. So that's a very significant amount of time that many people didn't save for. And so they have the real risk of running out of their savings. So our plan helps address the real financial pressures that older seniors face. But all seniors need to know it will be there for them when they get there, so that they've got the extra help they need when they need it.
I think, I mean, a lot of the concerns you voiced there, could they not also apply to a lot of people under 75? I mean, particularly people in their 70s. A lot of people in that group are widowed. A lot of people in that group have disabilities, chronic health conditions. Again, I'm just wondering what the rationale for 75 is.
Well, it really does address the data, the statistics that tell us that seniors are really challenged, because they did not expect many when they were saving and setting their retirement goals back, you know, many, many years ago. They didn't necessarily expect to live as long as they're living now, and more seniors are living longer. So they are facing, and I've heard this as I've travel the country, and again, you know, in Nova Scotia and Cape Breton, I've heard that seniors are very worried about outliving their savings. So this is a way to address that challenge, that seniors didn't save for the long lives that they're now living, and they're facing real extra pressures, and that's why we've addressed it through the 75+.
You hinted before about traveling to Nova Scotia, being in Cape Breton. What and you talked a little bit about the things you've heard. What maybe did you hear here that you hadn't heard or hadn't heard as much in other parts of the country? What stands out to you about your traveling to Nova Scotia and to Cape Breton in particular?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for asking that, because it was a real pleasure to have the chance to visit. The beginning of 2020, before the pandemic hit, I had the chance to meet with a variety of groups in different ridings in Nova Scotia. And what I heard mostly was that there was a challenge from seniors to stay in their homes. There are more seniors on average living in Nova Scotia and in the Atlantic provinces than in other provinces across the country. So there's a higher proportion of seniors. Many were telling me that they needed more programs to help them stay active and engaged. Mental health and isolation was a real challenge, especially in the more rural areas of the Atlantic provinces. And they were looking for what are we doing to help with that. And I wanted to just let your listeners know that in this the past year during the pandemic, we've funded over 5,000 community projects that have been there to support seniors all across the country, including rural and remote. I was very focused on making sure that we were getting the money out to those smaller communities that potentially had more challenges to get the volunteers, get the support that seniors needed. And I've been absolutely inspired by the community organizations that have stepped up to help seniors get the services that they need and get the supports that they need during this challenging time.
When you're talking to seniors, are you hearing much about a national pharmacare program? Because I know there's lots of concern about drug costs, especially among lower income seniors. And there has been a lot of talk for a long time now about a national pharmacare program. Has that issue come up in your consultations? And if so, what do you say to people?
Absolutely. This is a very significant issue for seniors right across the country, more so I'd say in the Atlantic provinces. I want people to know that we are on this journey to have a national pharmacare plan. We've already taken several steps with setting up a new Canadian drug agency, developing a national formulary by that drug agency that will then be able to be negotiated with the provinces and territories and applied. And we want to work on a national strategy for high-cost drugs for rare diseases, because we know the challenges that creates for those that have those very rare diseases and face extreme costs to be able to get treatment. So we've invested over $500 million per year in 2022-23 to be able to work on that strategy to be able to address that concern. And we are already working with the provinces and territories to deliver on pharmacare, find the provinces and territories that are ready to move with us and move forward on this important aspect of healthcare that Canadians need and deserve.
So that is a commitment then, because I know people have been talking about a national pharmacare program for a long time, but it's not just preliminary steps. You're saying there is a fundamental commitment over the next few years to develop that program.
Absolutely, and we've already been on that journey and taken steps, right? So first the task force to give us advice on how to move forward, the development of the National Drug Agency, working on the national formulary, that is work already underway.
What's the timeline, do you think?
You know what? The COVID pandemic has certainly made things more challenging, because the focus was obviously on vaccines and the pandemic response and making sure that we got through this safely and that we supported Canadians to get through with all the other programs. But it is very, very important, and we are moving forward on it. I won't give you a timeline because we're still in the pandemic and we're still responding there. But all this work that I've already mentioned is underway.
And finally, you mentioned before about the conditions in long-term care homes. I mean, it is a provincial jurisdiction, but Ottawa has put up some money, and you alluded to some of the actions Ottawa is taking. Can you say a little bit more about what role Ottawa is playing in what's essentially a provincial jurisdiction, but is really, as a Minister of Seniors, very much under your mandate as well?
Absolutely. So the situation in long-term care was a national shame and embarrassment, and we must do better. As I mentioned, all levels of government need to step up and do better. So right from the beginning of the pandemic, I want people to know that the federal government was there supporting the provinces and territories, even in some circumstances, as you saw in Ontario and Quebec, bringing in the military to deal with homes in crisis. But we were also there to provide PPE. Billions of dollars was provided to purchase PPE to be able to distribute to the provinces and territories, which then distributed them to long-term care. We also helped step up with wage subsidies to be able to help those frontline essential workers and PSWs, personal support workers, that were working under extreme circumstances during the pandemic, to make sure that they were rewarded for going into work and working hard to keep seniors safe in those facilities. But there was also advice through for infection prevention control that was also shared, to be able to help get advice from what we were learning about the pandemic and how we needed to protect seniors in those facilities. So we've provided billions of dollars of support. We've provided $1 billion recently for the provinces and territories to improve their infection prevention control within all of the long-term care facilities, and share the lessons learned and make sure that is shared across the country, so we can do better, because obviously that was a really serious issue. And we've also provided funding through infrastructure to be able to do air filtration, air conditioning, and sprinkler systems to improve the safety of those living in long-term care. So we've been there with significant funding and support, and as I mentioned, the military and the Red Cross, but now we're stepping up again with $3 billion to work to enact standards for long-term care, make sure they're applied and that permanent changes are made. So that's where we've been. We've been there. It's not our jurisdiction, as you've mentioned, but we are partners, and so we are there to support the provinces and territories to make improvements in long-term care.
Now, I know it's early stages now, but when you say national standards, what provisionally, at least, do you have in mind?
So what's happening right now is the Health Standards Organization and the Canadian Standards Association are working with government stakeholders and Canadians to develop standards. This is their business. This is their very very experienced at doing this with hospital standards and equipment standards across Canada. They do national standards all the time. So that work that they have underway right now will inform our discussions with the provinces and territories, and that work is now underway.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Deb?
I just want your listeners in Cape Breton to know that the Canadian government has been listening to them, that we want to make sure that we're there to provide supports and provide the services that are needed, and that there's much more work to be done, as you know, and we'll be there to support them and to be there to listen and keep making improvements.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Minister Schultz. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Dave, for having me on your show.
Cape Bretoners recently said goodbye to someone who made a huge impact on people from all walks of life across the island and beyond its shores. If you were to read Jim St. Clair's resume, you'd wonder if it's the work, passion, and accomplishments of just one person. But his friends and the people who knew him best would tell you the list of interests and accomplishments is probably just scratching the surface. The educator, storyteller, broadcaster, and historian recently passed away at the age of 90, and we caught up with one of his many friends on Dialogue, Rodney Chesson.
So Jim grew up in the States. He came to Cape Breton with his family to their family farm in Mull River. And growing up and spending time with his family and grandparents, he certainly learned to appreciate the story of Cape Breton and the importance of the culture and genealogy. He came back in his young adulthood, and accepted a position with the Gaelic College at the time with A.W.R. McKenzie. And then later on in life, he came back to Cape Breton. He kept coming back in the summertime. And then he came back as a teacher. He taught full-time in Mabu and then eventually professor at the University College of Cape Breton. But he's well-known to everybody as a historian, teacher, broadcaster, and a good mentor to a lot of people in the heritage community.
And he had a Harvard education, right? Both of his degrees came from Harvard.
Yeah, but Jim understood the importance of education, but he also understood the wisdom that came from some of our traditional education as well that wasn't institutionalized. So he had a way of being able to marry the two, and he saw the benefits of both. There's no point that he would have, even being Harvard, he didn't come with any degree of snootiness or anything. It wasn't a case of Harvard educating and I gotta work into this rural Cape Breton thing. That wasn't Jim at all. Jim really embraced the wisdom that came from the traditions, and that was important to him.
Can you talk about your friendship with Jim? How did you know each other?
I met Jim at what was then the University College of Cape Breton. He was a museum studies and a teacher or a professor in the Bachelor of Arts Community Studies program. So I had him for the core course for that program. It was called Problem-Centered Studies. And he was also teaching the museum studies courses as well, because there was a museum studies option at the time. So that's where I met Jim and got to know Jim very well. He was a professor like none other. He introduced us to the heritage, not only the heritage of the island, but he took us to communities across the island. We visited museums. We met with the people that worked in those museums, whether they were volunteers or paid staff. He took us to meet other people that were working in genealogy and other parts of heritage and culture. Of course, telling us stories along the way of who lived in that particular house and walking up Cape Mabu and seeing foundations and learning all about the people that lived in those foundations and all kinds of other excursions. It was an incredible experience. And for a student learning about Cape Breton and the culture and getting a foothold in the museum community, it was an introduction like another.
And the people who knew him well, those who say they had the pleasure of meeting him too, as an acquaintance, they speak about his presence and basically he could have command of a room, but in a very humble way.
He had an incredible way of connecting with people. And it was funny because anywhere I traveled with him, he would run into people he knew or found a way to connect with the people. Then if I traveled to Timbuktu with him, he would find a way to connect with them or connect them to the island. It was quite incredible. we noticed that, or I should say, I saw it a lot during the period when he was doing candlelight tours behind the village, where we would have people coming from Kibbreton, of course, that would be coming to hear his stories because they knew him on the radio, and that we'd be coming the people coming home that were maybe cottaging it, or they had roots in Kibbreton, or they were just visitors that had no connection whatsoever. They were just tourists visiting Kibbreton. And he would find a way, if there was 20 people in the group, he would connect with each one of them individually. He would, if their story was from here, he would connect with that. If not, he would find another way to connect with them. It was quite incredible. And through this, telling the stories of the island and of our people.
Described as a master storyteller, and compelling is a word that comes to mind to describe his way of doing that. And is this how you would describe it too, Rodney?
Oh, very much so. And his stories were very much rooted in the tradition. And not just the Gaelic tradition and the Scottish tradition, but he was quite interested in all the traditions, Mi'kmaq and Acadian and Irish and Loyalist and the people that settled and called this place home. So he did a lot of research. He spent a lot of time combing through deeds and old diaries and all kinds of other archival materials, as well as listening to stories. Even in his youth, he would have been listening to stories, visiting tradition bearers in the community around Mabo. So when he would share all of this information, whether it would be on the radio or in newspaper articles, in a classroom, or just giving a speech, a speech would include stories. And all of them really had meaning to him, or a way of showing the depth and breadth of Kibbreton Island.
So the way you describe him, it seems like he had a natural talent that it would be very hard to learn, that having the ability to garner someone's attention and want to learn and be entertained by someone. Does this also describe Mr. Sinclair?
Oh, absolutely. And he was Harvard educated, and so he could certainly recite classics and had a handle on the English language and like I've never seen. But he could run into the average Joe on the street and connect in a very important way. He just had that incredible breadth of being able to connect with people.
So many of us now, we find our entertainment on the television or Netflix, and the art of storytelling may not, it's not what it used to be, I suppose. Do you know what Jim thought about that? Did he embrace technology in that way, or did he see it as a way of taking away from the craft of storytelling?
He saw some opportunity with that, especially with internet and being able to record things. He did a recording of storytelling with the Storytelling Society of Canada, he saw some opportunity. Actually, one of our more recent conversations is really about how we utilize Zoom and other types of technology to bring the museum to the classroom. So he saw some potential, certainly for that. Concerns that younger kids and the younger generation are really spending more time on their iPhones or computer screens than digging into the past. But he also saw the opportunity of using technology to bridge that gap. And children and youth were a big thing for him. He really wanted to see the museum, challenge the museum community to really bridge that gap and how we would get into the school system and how we would reach out to kids. Because for Jim, learning about the past wasn't just about learning about the past. It was how you can learn from the past and incorporate that to make better communities today and tomorrow. It was what can we do and what can we learn from the past to really, in community development is really what it was focused on. How do we improve our communities? How do we grow our communities based on those learnings from the past?
So for someone like you who had a chance to hear a lot of his stories, if it doesn't put you on the spot there, Rodney, is there an anecdote or something that left an impact with you that you'd like to share with us?
I'm not a storyteller. I've enjoyed all of Jim's stories over the years, but I've never been able to get the knack of storytelling myself, so I couldn't do justice to
him. No, I hear you. Some of us are definitely better listeners than speakers, but I guess, what about Jim, though? Was he a good listener? Both sides of a conversation being important, I guess, huh?
Oh, absolutely. He could tell a story, but he'd also listen, and he had a great way of probing. Maybe you're having a discussion and he wants to learn more. He had a great talent for probing with the right questions to get further information.
And before we go, Rodney, it should be mentioned that Mr. Sinclair was someone who connected with many generations. People of all ages appreciated his legacy and the impact that he leaves on the community.
Oh, absolutely. And he had a big following with his Wednesday program on CBC. Anywhere he went, and his voice was so distinct. Actually, my daughter was signing onto her grade 12 class, a virtual class, and the teacher was playing a recording from Jim, and she said, "Oh my God, that sounds like Jim." And yeah, they were very. And he did have that ability to connect with all ages. Whether it was sitting down with somebody in their 80s or 90s, this would have been a while ago, connecting with them on stories or sharing a tea or whatever, or as I mentioned, telling a story in the church and really connecting with kids. He had a wonderful ability just to connect with everybody.
And just about his legacy, he's obviously, he won't be forgotten easily, I would assume.
No, certainly not, and not by those of us that were fortunate enough to spend time with him. He was a definite treasure. I will forever value the time that I got to spend with him. It was a real treat, whether as a university student or as somebody working with the Hyman Village or just somebody that I could have lunch with and be friends with. He was an incredible individual, and I know. I couldn't count the number of people that probably feel the same way and have had similar interactions with him.
Okay, so we're talking with Rodney Chesson, a friend of the late Jim Sinclair, who recently passed away. Well known as a leader in many ways, connecting with people in his interests in education, local history, and storytelling, just to name a few of his talents. And we'll close out with Jim in conversation with the Heritage Cape Breton Connection. Rodney, thanks very much for your time today, and all the best to you, and our condolences for the loss of your friend.
Oh, well, thank you, and I'm pleased that... You guys are actually doing your part to share the story of Jim and what he meant to Cape Breton.
I was born in Lynn, Massachusetts, in 1930. I did spend some of my childhood in Lynn. We were in Mull River every summer. Actually, I was in Mull River the summer before I was born. Mm-hmm. My mother was pregnant. Then we lived some of the rest of the time in... another suburb of Boston, where I went to high school, and then I went on to Harvard College, and then to graduate school at Harvard. I came to stay year-round in 1970, and began teaching in Marble School in 1971. It was a very wonderful opportunity when I was a freshman in college that I was able to get a job as a summer assistant to A.W.R. McKenzie, the founder of the Gaelic College. My job as his assistant was to drive his car, mm-hmm. to do his typing, to prepare his press releases. If the cook didn't show up, I cooked for the kids that were in the summer school. If the Gaelic teacher didn't come, I met the kids and we sang Gaelic songs. I took them swimming in the afternoon. I took them when they went to the Bell when they went to the home of the Grosvenors on the Bell Estate as entertainers for the Grosvenors' distinguished visitors. Whatever had to be done that he didn't want to do, I got to do. And it was a great experience because I met all kinds of people who were involved with culture or would be involved with culture, would be involved with heritage. For me, then, it gave me an insight into how government works with cultural institutions and how important it was to recognize the significance of government, because the Gaelic College benefited or was derelict at times because of the change in government. The Highland Village, celebrating 50 years, slowly moved from an outdoor concert which raised money to keep open a small log building which housed some artifacts. It had a start as the institution which was to fulfill the dream of Angus L. MacDonald for a village or a replica village to identify Hebridean Gaelic culture, West Coast Hebridean culture. The Board of Trade here saw a cultural entity such as the Highland Village to be a stimulus to local economy as farms declined, as fishing ended here. And they applied to this Society of Scottish, this Federation of Scottish Societies in Nova Scotia, to be the location for a Highland village, call it what you will, Quakin Gaelic. And Ganish wanted it, and Pictou County wanted it. And Pictou County thought it had because of the hectare. And because of its political clout, which it's always had in Halifax, much more than Iona had, it thought it had a shoo-in to get the site. But curiously enough, the first presentation was written and made in Gaelic, and that startled the people who were on this decision-making committee from the Federation of Scottish Societies. And it made them stop and think. And then A.D. MacKinnon, who was the Presbyterian minister in Little Narrows and Waikawa, and was a fluent, marvelous Gaelic preacher, he made another presentation in Gaelic, and all of a sudden, the mood changed. With that kind of background, in the language, this institution, the site came to be the site for the developing institution, but there was no money, and there was no money for some years. One of the things that I think the village has been that we don't always say is that it has been a place where individuals have developed skills. Mm-hmm. We don't always think of cultural institutions as being educational institutions, mm-hmm. but it works. The cultural federations came into being in order to promote the concept of public education in the arts throughout the province, under the encouragement of the provincial government, but not under the direction of the Department of Education. Right. So these activities, such as museums and heritage, choral groups, multiculturalism, writers, drama, and visual arts were sort of thought of as ways in which communities would gain an understanding of their own strengths and backgrounds, and would be adult education courses less academic than any extension programs offered by universities. It was a very brilliant concept, and it was at one time under the recreation department. Mm-hmm. And the Federation of Heritage was encouraged by the person who was in charge of formulating the concept mm-hmm. of these federations. Louis Stevens was an able, capable man, and he chose Elizabeth Ross to be the first executive director of the Federation of Nova Scotian Heritage. She had some very definite ideas about grassroots growth mm-hmm. of heritage and museums, and she believed in the significance of good training. She was the right person at the right time for the development of the number of museums which came into being as a result of the stimulus of the centennial. The stimulus which the Federation gave for training and self-respect encouraged people, I think, to view themselves as people living all around this island as having the right and the responsibility to meet and to talk about their particular concerns. The name Iona Connection came about as a result of connection, but because of the island of Iona being the place in Scotland to which St. Columba came from Ireland and brought Christianity to Scotland, and the people who came to this little island of Iona and formed in the 500s this colony of Christians, then moved out from Iona to the rest of Scotland, establishing churches and monasteries, but they would always come back to Iona and report what they had done. So there was that outward motion and the coming back to talk to one another about where things were. At any rate, that was kind of the thinking in calling this the Iona Connection, was go out and come back, go out and come back and talk about what's going on. The Iona Connection has fulfilled a major function in bringing people together, which was its task. It has had some projects which have been beneficial on an island-wide basis. It has been the model by which other organizations, both in the province of Nova Scotia and some other places, have looked at regional museological or cultural groups and how they can form mm-hmm. without much money. I mean, the Iona Connection never had any money. Mm-hmm. It didn't have government funding. It cost very little to belong. Mm-hmm. The museum fed the museum where the meetings were held initially just fed the people mm-hmm. when they came at their own expense. The Gaelic College did that several times. Mm-hmm. The Iona Connection came to have an icon significance for people who didn't really know what it was. Mm-hmm. But knew there was something happening out there which pulled the museum, the heritage types together. See, from my vantage point, there are very few institutions on this island which cross Kelly's Mountain. Mm-hmm. CBU never has, sadly enough. CBC doesn't even reach the whole island from Sydney. Once you get beyond Mabo into Port Hood and Jurdick and Port Hawkesbury, mm-hmm. they hear CBC Halifax. Mm-hmm. So the Iona Connection has done something in the way in which it's brought people from Cape North to Port Hastings to St. Peter's, from Glace Bay, from Dominion, from North Sydney, from Lake Ainslie, from Shetty Camp, mm-hmm. Marguerite, Porto, and Mago together at least twice a year. And nothing else has done exactly that. I think that's commendable and it's been really worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of things to be done. I think it'll continue. I think the Ayana connection will probably have more significance in the long run on this island than the Association of Nova Scotia Museums will have. I think a person has to spend, I think you have to, in heritage on Cape Breton Island,
mm-hmm.
you have to spend some time, like A.W.R. Mackenzie sitting on hillsides, looking out to see what there is. I have every admiration for the depth of caring of people on this island for local history, local storytelling. It takes that kind of drive,
mm-hmm.
in order for the heritage to be identified and the way in which it is promoted and carried on to take root.
Bill Bradley from The Coast Morning Show speaks with artist producer Keith Mullins and three other Cape Breton artists, Morgan Tony, Isabella Sampson, and Jesse Cox. And they're going to talk about the release of their new music to Bandcamp. The three spent the last 6 months each making a solo album with Keith at Barnbrea Studios in Bedeque.
I woke up from a dream last night. I was chasing fireflies. I was running around in the dark with cold hands in a mason jar.
Under lockdown here in Nova Scotia, and before the lockdown started, a guy that's had some great success here in the East Coast, songs like Fireflies, Shine, and Stronger Together. It's a pleasure to welcome Keith Mullins. Welcome.
Hey, Bill. It's great to be here.
Now, you've been busy despite the fact that lockdown, up until that point, you had all kinds of gigs, four or five gigs a week, and all of a sudden that just stopped, and then you're like, uh-oh, what do I do now?
Pretty much, yeah. I had a tour to United Kingdom. I had a big Sobeys gig. I had a ton of festivals, a ton of schools. They were all canceled. And then that was it.
And now you've got this new project that you just started. It's probably a lifelong dream for you. You had a lot of the gear and thought,
uh-huh.
hey, let's build a studio. Of course, I don't know if you're thinking about Alexander Graham Bell, what you're thinking about, but Barnbrea.
That's exactly it, yeah, which means beautiful burn. And I can actually, from the top of my house, I can actually see Barnbrea.
Oh, really? That's kind of cool.
So, it was a dream of mine. So from like June until September of last year, I took 3 months and went at it every day and built a studio. And then I had these three artists in mind, Morgan Tony, Isabel Sampson, and Jesse Cox. And we kind of went through all the grants together and I helped them write their grants. And then, we took all the songs and I helped them co-write the songs and then produced the songs for them and made it all happen. It's a beautiful thing.
And we have those three artists on the line with us right now. First of all, we're going to start off with Morgan Tony. Morgan, welcome.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
Fantastic. How about you?
I'm doing fine. Parked on the side of the road here in the middle of nowhere.
Now, when you first started out in music, is it true that you didn't know how to play the fiddle?
Correct. I did not know how to play the fiddle, but I did know how to play the drums. And I somehow picked up the fiddle at Cape Breton University, and I just stuck with it.
Now, you owe a lot of credit to Keith Mullins, but also even before that, to Ashley McIsaac as well.
Yeah. So back in October of last year, it was during the summertime, I got a call from Dawn Beaton, and she was like, hey, we love your videos. You're doing an amazing job playing the instrument. We want to know if you want to come and play at the Celtic Colors Festival. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And a week prior to that, or 2 weeks prior to the whole festival, I found out that I was playing in at the opening concert for the Celtic Colors, and that I was playing alongside Ashley McIsaac. So that was a huge surprise, and I got to meet Ashley. We got to practice a lot together, and he was just like a mentor, and now he's a great friend.
Well, when you first came on the scene, you were a breakout artist and sounded great, by the way. Now teaming up with Keith Mullins and producing an album. How would you describe the album?
I would describe it like a journey, you know. So we're taking Mi'kmaq songs, and we are adding a new perspective onto it. So there's a lot of fiddle sets in there, not as much because we really wanted to focus on the songs. So there's maybe three fiddle sets, but the rest are all songs. And I was thinking about it today when I was driving to this spot in the middle of nowhere. All the songs have teachings in it. And I grew up with these seven sacred teachings, you know, the wisdom of the elders, and it's all there in this album. And it's a beautiful album with a beautiful message all around. And I highly recommend people to listen to it.
And what's the name of the album, and how can folks go about getting it?
So it's called First Flight. I've got to tell you a quick little story, if you don't mind, Bill. Okay, so how the album name came. I was in Orangedale doing a ceremony with my friend. And during the ceremony, he passed me over his ceremonial drum. And he said, play a tune. Whatever comes first in your head, play from your heart. And I was like, okay. So I started to play the Mi'kmaq Honor song, which is like the most important song in our entire repertoire. And I started singing, and all of a sudden there's this baby eagle flying right over me. And he stayed there until the song was over, then he flew away. And my friend, who's very spiritual, he said, that is your spirit name. And it just came to me, and it's Nutgwe Gitbu, which translates to young eagle. So in a way, I'm the young eagle, and I'm taking my first flight. You know, this is my first album.
Couldn't have planned it any better had something like that. I mean, it's just, it was meant to be.
Yeah, and there's Mike Bates, my good friend from Sydney, who came up with the name, and I said, yeah, that's the one we're going with.
Now, how can folks go about getting the album?
We are using this wonderful little app called Bandcamp, and it's not just an app. People can go to www.bandcamp.com, and you can search us up. You have to create an account with Bandcamp. It's free of charge. You follow us, and you're able to purchase the album. All you have to do is put your card info in, and there you go. And what's a cool alternative, you can send these albums as gifts to someone, you know, to anybody. Cool. The album is $10.
They can get it through Bandcamp on the app.
They can get it through Bandcamp. That's correct.
Well, I tell you, I'm a fan of your music since I heard the very first single. I tell you, it sounds awesome.
Hey, thank you so much, Bill.
Now, Keith, there's another artist that you're working with is Isabella. Now, you've been working, you've heard her at a young age, and she's just what? Isabella, you're 16?
Just turned 17.
Now. Turned 17. And that matters when you're a teenager, right?
Now, or when you only got 16 years to yourself.
Exactly. So when you we're first thinking about working with Isabella, Keith. What came to mind about her voice, and what did you think that you could do as far as getting the message and the music out there?
Yep. Well, I first met Isabella at Bandemonium, which is like a music camp in St. Peter's. And actually, there's a huge group of young musicians in St. Peter's that are really strong musicians. I came to the camp and I saw Isabella playing. I'll never forget it. She was playing from from an iPad, and people were asking her to play songs, and she'd bring it up on the iPad and then play all the chords and then sing. And then she'd be nailing the harmonies to them. And she was like 13, and she just blew my mind. And I actually first started to hire her as a sideman role, where she would like learn my tunes and show up and sing harmonies and play with me. And she's just such a strong musician that she's like a one take one. And she's right there, and I'm talking about her. So,
well, Isabella, yeah, she's with us on the line right now, and that's nice to hear. You just turned 17, as Keith had mentioned. How did you start out doing music at such a young age?
Well, I actually started probably singing since I was at home, but I started piano lessons when I was 4, and going through my life, I've been singing in church choir, which is where I learned a lot of techniques, you know, harmonizing and learning how to sing with a group and how to know your place in that kind of situation. And since then, I've been, you know, playing at any show I could get my hands on, go grown up.
Must be tough now with the COVID lockdown going on. And, of course, the musicians look forward to the summer for some great gigs. But everything is kind of up in the air now. So where does that leave you?
There's always live streams. And my new album did just come out, which is a big thing. So I'm hoping for, you know, COVID to die down a bit in the summer so we can get some festivals in.
Okay. And what is the name of your album?
And my album is If It's Not Forever.
And how many tracks are we looking at on that album?
8 tracks.
How long did it take you to put these 8 tracks down?
It took a few months. We had gotten the grant, I want to say November-ish. And, you know, we've been working on it since then, writing songs and recording the songs in Keith's studio, Barn Brea.
Now, if folks want to get the album, I'm sure they can get it on Bandcamp as well, right?
Sure.
Yeah, just go to the app, Bandcamp. Now, I'm learning something new here today. I'm definitely going to download that app and check it out for myself. It was nice to talk to you here today, Isabella, and good luck with your music career.
Thank you.
Now, another guy, Keith, that can we say that he's turned fisherman singer or still fishing and singing is Jesse Cox?
Yeah, that's right. He's I actually just got him for the lobster, you know.
I don't blame you there.
No, Jesse's a fantastic songwriter. He happens to be a fisherman as well up in Bay St. Lawrence, but just all I can say is just check out the music, man. It's really, really fantastic.
Now, Jesse's with us on the line as well. Jesse, how would you describe your music?
Thanks for having me, Bill. Kind of a rootsy, alternative country kind of sound, I guess.
So when did you get the feel for music? When, did you get it at an early, early age and you just got the bug and decided, hey, this could be a career for me?
My parents actually had an album and they toured around. So I was at a lot of festivals and 3-day parties, stuff like that. It's just music the whole time. Ingrained in me, I guess. I always wanted to play.
Your parents opened up for Rita McNeil and Matt Minglewood, didn't they?
Yes. Multiple times. They played at festivals and arenas around the island with them.
Your album, how many tracks is on that album that you have out that's also available on Bandcamp, I'm assuming?
8 tracks, yep, and it's available on Bandcamp.
Well, sir, it's nice to chat with you, and good luck with your music career.
All right. I just started the fishing season here in Bay St. Lawrence. I'd like to give a quick shout-out, if that's all right.
Sure, go ahead.
Quick shout-out to my skipper, my captain, Fred Lawrence, and crewmate, Sarah Burwash, and all the fishermen, fisherwomen across the island, really. Good luck on the season.
Well, thanks again, sir, and good luck with your new 8-track.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thanks.
No problem. Well, folks, it's been so nice chatting with each and every one of you, and good luck in your music career, and hopefully this lockdown is going to end soon, and, you know, maybe a couple of more weeks, it'll get back to somewhat kind of normalcy.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
That's all for Dialogue this week on the Coast 89.7. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.